Proverbs chapter 28 has a few proverbs that are kind of extra powerful, like verse 2 is one, verse 8 is one, verse 9, and verse 13 is another one. Verse 13 about the confession of sin. And it says, "He that covereth his sins shall not prosper." It's called a cover-up. "But whoso confesseth and forsaketh them shall have mercy from God." Okay, the example at the word covereth of men in the Bible who covered their sins is Joshua 7 with Achan, where he stole that Babylonian garment and the wedge of gold or silver and hid it. Okay, he's an example. And then King Saul. Let's try King Saul. Let's look at his. 1 Samuel chapter 15. If you look at the life of King Saul versus King David, it would appear that David's life was had more baggage there. It appeared that he had immorality problems, not like Saul. There's no record of Saul committing adultery or anything like that. Saul did attempt murder. But in 1 Samuel 15, this shows a counterfeit repentance. And when you read down through this, you'll see how not to confess sin. Or another way is saying this is how you cover it up. You'll see in 1 Samuel 15, verse 3, the command. Okay, this is what he is supposed to do. In this battle, he is supposed to smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have, spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. That's the orders. Okay, that's the military orders. And if you pick it up about verse 8, there's the disobedience, verse 8 and 9, where Saul spared Agag the king and the best of the sheep, oxen, the fatlings, and lambs, and all that was good. So there's the disobedience. And then the cover-up. Okay, the cover-up begins when Samuel shows up and questions Saul. And verse 15, well, verse 14, let's back up verse 13. "And Samuel came to Saul and said unto, and Saul said unto him, Blessed be thou of the Lord." That's a real pious talk. "I have performed the commandment of the Lord." That's a bald-faced lie. He has not performed the commandment of the Lord. "And then Samuel said, What meaneth then this bleating of the sheep in mine ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? And Saul said, They have brought them from the Amalekites." Notice he's throwing the blame on they, the people. "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep of the oxen to sacrifice unto the Lord." Oh, ain't that real pious? You know, I've broken that person's house to steal their money, but, you know, you can guarantee I'm going to tithe on it. Okay, so it says, "The sacrifice unto the Lord thy God and the rest we have utterly destroyed." So he's not taking any blame in there. "And Samuel said unto Saul, Stay, and I will tell thee what the Lord hath said to me this night. And he said unto him, Stay on. And Samuel said, When thou wast little in thine own sight, wast thou not made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed thee king over Israel? And the Lord sent thee on a journey, and said, Go and utterly destroy the sinners of the Amalekites, and fight against them until they be consumed. Wherefore then didst thou," personal pronoun, you, Saul, "not obey the voice of the Lord, but didst fly upon the spoil, and this evil in the sight of the Lord. And Saul said unto Samuel, Yea, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord, and have gone the way which the Lord sent me, and have brought Agag the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took of the spoil the sheep and oxen. See, he's blaming the people. That's a typical bureaucrat. If there's a success, he takes the credit. If there's a failure, he, of course, pointing the finger at everybody else. So he's blaming the people, passing the buck, and it says that the people took the spoil of sheep and the oxen, the chief of the things which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice unto the Lord thy God in Gilgal. Samuel said, hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices, and as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, it is to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. So he's obviously telling Saul, you are rebellious, you are stubborn. And then it says, because thou, the TH is personal pronoun, because thou hast rejected the word of the Lord, he hath also rejected thee from being king. And Saul said unto Samuel, I have sinned. Well, it looks like that's a confession, but it's not valid. I have sinned. There are several fellows that have said that and went to hell. Balaam said that. Pharaoh said that. Let's see. In Joshua 7, Achan said that. In Matthew 27, 4, Judas Iscariot said that. I have sinned. Then he says, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and thy words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. That's not a true confession. That's passing a buck again on the people. Now therefore I pray thee, pardon my sin and turn again with me, that I may worship the Lord. Sorry, pal, you're out. And Samuel said unto Saul, I will not return with thee, for thou hast rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord hath rejected thee from being king over Israel. Okay, so there's a cover-up. That's how you cover up your sin. You don't confess it. You don't admit it. You blame somebody else. You give yourself an excuse. I've got my weaknesses. You know, I just didn't understand. I misunderstood. You know, it was somebody else's fault. It couldn't have been me. No, surely it couldn't have been me. It has to be somebody else. Somebody as holy and righteous as me, it surely couldn't have been me. Okay, that's a cover-up. Okay, and then the other side is, whoso confesseth and forsaketh them shall have mercy. Now, there are examples of confession. Let's see if I have them down in here. Nope, so you can add and write these things in there. Psalms 51, the entire psalm is David confessing a sin about Uriah and Bathsheba. 1 John 1:9, if we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. 1 John 1:7, the blood of Jesus Christ, God's Son, cleanses us from all sin. Now there are two men that give illustrations or examples of proper confession of sin. Of course, it's not in the telephone booth, you know, to some priest. Okay, and they're found in Ezra chapter 9 and Daniel chapter 9. Both of these men demonstrate proper confession of sin. Ezra 9 verse 5, if you read all the way down through there, all the way down to the end. 15. Ezra 9, 5 to 15, that's Ezra's example of proper confession of sin. You'll see that his outward demonstration of that is found in verse 3. Now, the sin that they're dealing with here in Ezra 9 is interracial marriages between the Jews and the blacks. Okay, under the Old Testament, the Jewish race and everything, that was a sin. But you'll also find occurrences where Moses married an Ethiopian woman. David married Bathsheba. Bathsheba's got some Hamite blood in her. And Solomon, many of his wives were Hamites. And now in Nehemiah 13, it mentions that Solomon transgressed when he married outlandish women, outside the land women. Okay, and that's what Ezra 9 is dealing with, Ezra 9 and 10. And what Ezra is telling these people, he noticed that they had married outside of their faith and race. Ezra 9, verse 1 and 2, mingled themselves. Verse 3 is his reaction. When I heard this thing, I rent my garment and my mantle and plucked off the hair of my head and of my beard and sat down in stone age. Now that's quite a reaction. Pull your hair out. And then 4 says, then were assembled unto me everyone that trembled at the words of the Lord, of God of Israel, because of the transgression of those that have been carried away, and I sat astonied until the evening sacrifice. He's really burdened about this. And notice his attitude, or his proper confession. Verse 5, you'll see he has a heaviness. Verse 5. Verse 5, he fell on his knees. Verse 6, he's ashamed of himself, and he blushes. You know, when you see these queers, you know, I'm gay and God loves me too, that's not a born-again believer, because a Christian should be ashamed of themselves and blush because of their sin. Okay, so verse 3, he says, oh my God. That's real praying. Oh my God, I am ashamed and blush to lift up my face to thee. He's ashamed and he doesn't even want to look up to God. For our iniquities are increased over our head and our trespasses grown up upon the heavens. And you read down through there, that's Ezra's demonstration of confession. Okay, let's try Daniel. Daniel chapter 9. That's the kind of confession God is looking for at the National Day of Prayer. If America's going to have a National Day of Prayer, which they do have an official one, usually in May, and if all these religious folks get together, if they would pray and confess the sins of our nation like that, God may do something for our country. Do you remember, I'm sure many of you remember, hearing about some prayer that got some guy prayed, I think it was in Nebraska or Kansas, it was in Kansas. And Paul Harvey read this prayer where they got all bent out of shape, and all he was praying was praying about, you know, how our country's got abortion and things like this. And it was a gentle prayer, but yet he called sin as sin. And after he got done praying, all them Democrats, you know, them guys just went berserk. How can he say such a thing? How can he pray such a thing? And all those things. And this has been probably several years ago, but I remember it went to the point where Paul Harvey read this thing on the air, showing how ignorant these guys were in Kansas, the congressman. But if we had a nation prayed that on the National Day of Prayer, we might would see something happen in our country. Okay, Daniel 9, verse 3. All the way down to 19 is Daniel's example of confession. And of course, we know Ezra and Daniel provide two great examples in the Bible. The Lord said that Daniel, when he talked about wisdom, he said that Lucifer, or the anointed cherub, was wiser than Daniel. So that's quite a standard to use Daniel as an example. Okay, Daniel 9, verse 3. Daniel says this, I set my face unto the Lord God to seek by prayer and supplication with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. And I prayed unto the Lord my God and made my confession and said, O Lord, the great and dreadful God, keeping the covenant and mercy to them that love him and to them that keep his commandments, we have sinned and have committed iniquity, and have done wickedly, and have rebelled, even by departing from thy precepts and from thy judgments. Neither have we hearkened unto thy servants the prophets which spake in thy name to our kings, our princes, and our fathers, and to all the people of the land. O Lord, righteousness belongeth unto thee, but unto us confusion of faces as at this day. Now there's confession of sin. Verse 10, neither have we obeyed the voice of the Lord our God. Verse 11, yea, all Israel hath transgressed thy law. You get down to verse, 18, O my God, incline thine ear and hear, open thine eyes and behold our desolations in the city which is called by thy name. For we do not present our supplications before thee for our righteousness, but for thy great mercies. O Lord, hear, O Lord, forgive, O Lord, hearken and do, defer not for thine own sake, O my God, for thy city and thy people are called by thy name. That's real praying, that's confession. Okay, and then Psalms 51 is David's, and the basic thing that the Lord's looking for in confession is found in Psalms 51, verse 17. And during confession of sin, what we're doing is we're begging for God's mercy. But the basic thing that God is looking for is Psalms 51:17. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise. So that's what he's talking about when he says in Proverbs 28:13, where he says, whoso confesseth and forsaketh them, his sins, shall have mercy. That's the ones that get mercy from God. Okay, Proverbs 28:14. Happy is the man that feareth alway, but he that hardeneth his heart shall fall into mischief. That seems like an oxymoron. How can you be happy when you're scared? But the idea is fearing God. And when you fear God, it gives you happiness and joy. Job 5, verse 17, and it says that the man is happy who God chastens. And that would seem strange. Why would you be happy because God chastens you? Well, that shows that God cares for you. If he didn't care for you, he'd just leave you alone, and then you'd really mess it up. So God's corrections are showing that his love and his concern for us. Often in sports, like in little leagues, you ever notice in little leagues when a dad is a coach of a team that he's often hardest on his own son? Because he wants his son to be better than all the others. And so he'll kind of be rougher on him than he will on all the others. And sometimes they get to a point where they get to be a tyrant about those things. Okay, most of the time in little league, the biggest problem is the parents. You know, I coached Little League for many, many years, you know, when Brent first came through and then Luke came through. And fortunately, I don't know if I was ugly or enough, but fortunately, none of the parents griped at me. But my wife heard all the gripes when she was sitting in the bleachers. Why don't that coach do this? Why don't he do that? They'd never come to me and tell me, which I was grateful for. If they would have, I wouldn't listen anyway. It's funny, one time we had this, I was coaching this two boys and their mom, and was, you know, those kids were on Ritalin probably from day one. And I mean, they were just wired. And their mother and grandmother is the same way. And so here we are at practice, and she's yelling at the kid, and as soon as she yells to tell the kid to do something, I yelled right after she got done and said to do the exact opposite. Then she comes back and says, oh, do what your coach says. She quit yelling after that. But, you know, it turned out fine with them kids that year, but she learned to keep her mouth shut. But most of the trouble is always, you know, it's parents and those things. Okay, so verse 14, it says, happy is a man that feareth alway, but he that hardeneth his heart shall fall into mischief. Hardening of the heart, you'll see in 29 verse 1, called the hardening of the neck. Gets hard-hearted. And so we need to have a tender heart. In 2 Kings, I think it's 22:19, there's a young fellow named Josiah found a book in the temple. And the reason why the Lord showed Josiah some truths in that book that they found in the temple, he says in 2 Kings 22:19, it says his heart was tender. He had a tender heart towards God. And as a Christian, you need a tender heart towards God. You need a tough hide towards man, but you need to have a tender heart towards God. And try to keep it as tender towards God as you possibly can. And the way you do that is the same way you tenderize meat, is you beat it with a hammer. And the hammer that you want to use to tenderize your heart is found in Jeremiah 29:23, or is it 23:29? I think it's 23:29. Where it says, is not my word like a hammer that breaketh a rock in pieces. So we tenderize our heart by this book right here. 15, as a roaring lion and a raging bear, so is a wicked ruler over the poor people. Doctrinally, that's the Antichrist. Okay, and historically, that's any tyrant. Historically, the most tyrannic rulers will be a black man over black people. And that's generally what that's aimed at, a poor people. Idi Amin was an example of that. But the number one murder rate in our country is black on black. And you go to Africa and you put a black man in charge of a nation, you'll see that in 9 times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100, he'll kill his people in order to keep his tyrannical reign. And that's an example of that. So is a wicked ruler over a poor people. 16, the prince that wanteth understanding. Wanteth or lacketh. He's been found wanting. He's been found lacking. The prince, the politician, the bureaucrat, the president that wanteth understanding. He lacks understanding, is also a great oppressor. Okay, and you can put that on any society. You know, I don't understand these bureaucrats and these dictators and stuff where they just kill people right and left and just kill them. And they kill them because they're so insecure and they want to retain their headship and steal all this money from these people. But if they were gentle leaders of their people and was concerned for the wealth of their people like Mordecai, they would have, the people would put them at the top and want them to stay there, and the people would shower them with gifts. And they'd do it the right way instead of the wrong way. But as rule of thumb goes throughout history, men rule like beasts. And in the Bible, in Daniel chapter 7, a beast is an example of kings and kingdoms. And beasts operate on the survival of the fittest, the law of the jungle. And that's how most kingdoms will be run. The Gentiles exercise lordship. That's the way the Lord put it. And the Lord said, the servant of all is greatest of all. And that's why in America, public servant, they're supposed to be a public servant. That's how they began, as a public servant. A good example of a public servant in the Bible is Mordecai. Esther chapter 10, verse 3. And when you have true public servants, Proverbs 29, verse 2 says, when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. That will be America in its beginning stages. And you see, America, basically what a constitution is designed to do, a constitution is a job description of the political officials. The United States Constitution, the Constitution for the United States, that's how it's supposed to be. They always usually have it called the Constitution of the United States, but it's not of, it's for the United States. It's the Constitution that is the boundaries or the fence or the rules that the people place upon the national officials. Okay, now if President Bush came into Lowell, there would be a big, you know, to-do. Everybody would be all up in arms. We'd have a big parade. You'd have cops everywhere, security. But people don't realize that he is fourth down in the totem pole as far as true authority goes. Number one is the people. Number two is the local public officials. Number three is the state local state officials. And number four is the federal. That's the way the list is supposed to go. And so when you and I walk into town, he should be bowing down to us. That's if he would honor the Constitution. And the way it was originally set up, any state could shut down the federal government. Whenever I hear the federal government shut down, I'm glad. I rejoice over those things. And a state can shut it down. You see, we have two state senators in Indiana who are actually federal senators. We have 50 U.S. senators, or 50 congressmen, state congressmen, and of those 50, we were supposed to send two or three or four, whatever our requirement is, to go to D.C., not a national congressman. And then of our state senators, we send them to go instead of the upper state senators. You see, we have a counterfeit in there. And if a state didn't like what was going on in D.C., we would refuse to send our senators and congressmen, and then they could shut down the federal government, and the state has the highest authority. And that's the way it was supposed to set up. Before the Civil War, you could say the United States are, because you had states' rights. United States are all individual states. After the Civil War, you had United States is. It's all together. And you see, the wisdom in that is that the highest enforcement officer, if you call that, or peace officer, is your county sheriff. That's your highest officer. If an IRS agent or a federal agent or any of these federal officers came into your county, the sheriff has every lawful right to boot him out of the county, and he should. He has that right to do that. But often when a sheriff gets put in position, the feds come in and have to sign agreements so he don't do that. You see, when police come on a scene, if you got the local police there and here come the feds, the local give in to the fed, but it should never be. It's the local that has the highest authority. And you can see the wisdom in that. The wisdom is, if the local's higher than the state and the state's higher than the fed, who's going to take time to go to D.C. and try to fix it? You see, you don't get anywhere. But you can go locally here up to Crown Point and get your grievances locally, and you get some action. You know, my county, I can go right down to Rensselaer and put my grievances with the local officials in my county. I live right next to them and stuff like that. You can see some stuff going on. Now, if you do it on a statewide thing, then you run down to Indianapolis. But in order to get to D.C., forget it. And you see, this country was founded so wise, the founding fathers and the way they set up our country is so wise, but of course, you know, the counterfeits. And what our founding fathers did is they wanted all the public officials to have an oath and a bond. Why? Because we don't trust them. That's the purpose of the oath and bond. And you'll find the oath and a bond in Numbers chapter 30, verse 2, where a man binds his soul by an oath, and he is to keep his word. Okay, and so when you have the prince that wants, when you have a prince that lacks understanding or wanteth understanding, like it says here, he's a great oppressor. He oppresses the people. Thomas Jefferson said, and I can't remember the exact quote, but he basically said to his colleagues, he said, if we can keep the people alert to our affairs, then we will be good public servants. But if we cannot keep the people alert to our affairs, we will become wolves to devour the people. And that is so true. Was it Lord Acton, I think, that said that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely? And so there's a lot of truth in those things. And this Bible, the way Israel was set up, Old Testament, Israel was set up as a republic. A lot of people call it a theocracy, but technically, I would call it a theocratic republic, but because republic are laws that sets up for a commonwealth, Ephesians chapter 2, verse 12, you'll see Israel is called a commonwealth. If you look in a law dictionary, commonwealth is synonymous with republic. We have four states that were still called Commonwealth today. Kentucky, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and there's one more, I can't recall it. Okay, so Proverbs 28:16, the prince. See, the Bible deals with government. Old Testament deals with governmental structures, you know, 70% of the time, so you got to hit on these things. And people say, well, you talk about government too much. Well, I talk about it when the Bible talks about it. And if we don't understand our heritage, you're not being taught these things in public schools, that's for certain. And if we don't understand our heritage, we're going to lose it. And so we got to understand these things. We've got to know the law of the land. Okay, so the last half of the verse. But he that hateth covetousness shall prolong his days. Two things there. One is he's implying that princes are covetous. They have a tendency to want money. And of course, the money is found in D.C. Okay, the other thing is that you can live longer. Your life can be extended if you hate covetousness. There's a health method there. There's a physical health method. That's a health method that you don't have to jog. You don't have to get up early and jog down the street, thank God. You don't have to do sit-ups for it. You don't have to do push-ups. You don't have to eat crackers or, you know, oat bran and fruit and vegetables. Okay, there's a health method that's pretty easy to do. Just hate covetousness. But it's not as easy as it appears, is it? Not as easy because one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not covet. Okay, so there's a health method that a person needs. And in the application there is somebody's always trying to get rich, they're going to, you know, run themselves right in the grave. Verse 17, a man that doeth violence to the blood of any person shall flee to the pit. Let no man stay him. Kind of a strange verse. The idea, I suppose, is that he's going to the pit because of, be sure your sin's going to find you out. And if a man digs a pit, he's going to fall into it. Let no man stay him. That's where we have a legal term called a stay. See how that Bible, that art, I tell you, I've told this to Gene several times, and Gene Zimmerman, and I've learned so much more Bible because of our law classes, because it's all through this book. And when you see the way our law system is set up, you could see the Bible is, how the Bible has influenced our whole law system. And people say, well, the system's all messed up. Yeah, it is. The system itself is a good system. It's just that you got people who don't obey the rules. And that's the thing. You know, you go in court, obey the rules, read the rules, quote the rules. You know, and the judge gets mad at you, starts yelling at you. Just quote to him the code of judicial conduct where he's to be polite, courteous with all litigants. That's what I did to mine. You know, they hate that when they read the rules to them. Court would be so easy if they would obey the rules. But the thing is when they don't obey them, the guy up the ladder, he don't care if he disobeys them down the ladder. And so you got to do everything to get the thing running right. But the idea of blind justice, all this stuff was based on this book. And we have such a tremendous heritage in our country. Verse 18, whoso walketh uprightly shall be saved. Now there's a doctrinal verse you got to look at. Spiritually speaking, I would dare say if a man lives his life according to his conscience, he's going to do right. Eventually someone's going to show him the gospel and he's going to get saved because he does the right thing. But doctrinally, remember Proverbs, the underlying doctrinal viewpoint is the tribulation, showing a faith and work system during the tribulation. Historically, Old Testament salvation is a faith and work system, and whoso walketh uprightly shall be saved. With the idea of Ezekiel chapter 18, when a righteous man doeth that which is lawful and right, he shall save his soul alive. Ezekiel 18:27. Now, if a person doesn't rightly divide the scriptures, reading that verse, you could see why a person would think they're going to have to work their way for salvation. And if you don't rightly divide this book, boy, you can really get messed up. Whoso walketh uprightly shall be saved. But in the New Testament, whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. And so that's how, I don't understand how these guys come through this book without understanding dispensations or probably divisions of this book. But he that is perverse in his ways shall fall at once. Okay, the ultimate pervert will be the Antichrist. Okay, according to Daniel 11, he'll not have the desire for women. So he's either going to be a sodomite or a bisexual or something like that. He's going to be a real pervert. Okay, and the Lord's going to build him up for 7 years or 3.5 when he's indwelt by Satan, and then all of a sudden, whack, knock him right down. Okay, and that's basically how the Lord does that thing, because it's a greater fall. Verse 19, he that tilleth his land shall have plenty of bread. But he that followeth after vain persons shall have poverty enough. The implication is he's not out there working. Okay, so the idea is get out there and work. Most preachers' problems is they spend too much time in an air-conditioned office. And they don't get out and do anything. You know, they shake their hands, and their hands as smooth as a baby's behind, and then you wonder, man, how can they even deal with things in life? And the thing is you know, I like Paul's methods, you know, where Paul was a guy who paid his own way. And when I was pastor of one church, you know, I was farming, you know, with my dad and my brother. And I like that to a point where, you're paying your own way. When I went to the two churches, that's kind of hard to do. But there are some people in this country where they think, well, I'm in a ministry and I'm not going to lift my pretty little fingers, you know, and touch anything. And that's sin. That's a leech. That's what I call them, mutinaries. And the thing is Paul paid his own way. You know, I recently got a letter from some mission board trying to get some money for some missionary, and it said in there that this way they wouldn't have to worry about their financial needs. Well, then they're going to lose touch with the people, aren't they? You know, if they're living there high on a hog, you know, and all this stuff, then they're not even going to understand what the people are going through. How can they preach to them? How can they minister to them? And the thing is, you know, we all got to just work for a living. And then you got 1 Corinthians 9, where, you know, if a man ministers to you in spiritual things, and you pay him in carnal things. So there's a balance in there. Verse 20, a faithful man shall abound with blessings, but he that maketh haste to be rich shall not be innocent. The implications there is he's going to not do some things for the Lord because he's too busy working, trying to make some money. He's going to miss church because he's trying to make an extra buck. Now, I understand the swing shift, and I understand all that stuff. And I realize that, you know, certain professions have to be open 7, you know, days a week, 24 hours a day, you know, like nursing homes and things like that. But if a man is the owner of his own business, this country was much better off when they shut things down on Sunday. Now, we know the New Testament, we don't have to keep the Sabbath. We understand that. But our country was better off when things shut down on Sunday. People went to church. It's a much better nation that way, and it's a good principle to rest every 7. 1 in 7. And our country was, in the old days they'd call it the Sabbath day or the Lord's day, which is a good thing. And of course now people are too busy trying to make money, and they have dropped their faithfulness with the Lord, and then they wonder why they don't have the blessings of God. Verse 20. Faithfulness. That's what the Lord's looking for as far as ministry goes, being faithful. He that is faithful in least is faithful in much. Now, you know, it's a fine line as far as, you know, as far as pastoring church goes. You know, I want to be faithful to my duties and my tasks, but I also want to get men in here that can give you some things that I can't give you, or they've experienced some things that I haven't. And so I try to reach a balance in there. So I bring in certain folks that have gone through some things I haven't to try to give you more of a balance. But I want to be faithful to the Lord. And I understand, and I also believe that I'm a firm believer in taking vacations too, because your family is the most important thing as far as you're being a parent, and you got to take off. Like Jesus said, if you don't come apart, he told his disciples, you got to come apart, rest a while. And I know the summer months, the church attendance is usually lower because folks are taking vacation. That don't bother me at all. Because I like, for, you know, some preachers, that you know, they want you to leave on Monday, get back on Saturday, don't miss your place in church and all that stuff. And if you can do that, fine, that's a good thing. But if you take a family vacation and you get that opportunity, do it. Take that opportunity. Of course, gas prices are getting worse. You're not going to get that opportunity much longer. I don't think you're seeing the motorhomes on the highways as much this summer. As far as those things go, and of course, that's often what folks at the top don't want you to do. You see, traveling implies independence, and they don't like it when a nation can travel. You know, in China, they want you to give you a bicycle. You can go from place to place, and that way you can run them over with tanks when they come in town, like they did in, was it Tiananmen Square or whatever they did? Okay, and so the freedoms that, as far as traveling, as those start being diminished, of course we know why, the New World Order and stuff, but if you get an opportunity to take a vacation, take it. And if your vacation is going out in the mailbox and back, take that. You know, just spend some time away, spend some time alone. It's a good thing to do. A faithful man should abound with blessings. And when you take vacations, be in church on Sunday. Look in the Yellow Pages. If you want to look for a Bible-believing church, look in there, and if someone will say King James, and don't expect much, because you may not get much. But it's a good experience. And if you go to some of the, if you can't find one of those, go to some of these others. You know, we went on vacation in Florida. We went to a black church. You know, that was entertaining. You know, you get something out of that stuff. And just go to those places and play dumb and ask some questions in Sunday school. You know, a lot of these churches that, you know, the teacher in these Sunday school classes don't study, so they don't know how to teach it, you know, more than a 15-minute lesson. So what they do is they give about a 10-minute spiel, and then they give you a little section to study, and then they break you up in little groups. You know, that stalls for time. And your group talks, and your group talks, and your group talks, and you got about five groups, and then each of their groups gives their opinion about this. You see, the guy don't know what to say for 40 minutes. Well, that's your time to preach. You know, show them some stuff. And use those opportunities. They're great opportunities. And you'll find out what's going on in this country. Dead as the churches are. One time, our family's coming through, I think it was Kansas, and Janet Lyle was also, I think we were traveling together, so when our family and Janet Lyle's family walked in, I think we doubled the attendance that night, and this preacher was talking about revival, we need revival, revival this, revival that, revival this, and all this stuff, you know, and he's teaching from an NIV, and of course he didn't allow opportunity to speak that night, but I wrote him a little letter to him. I said, fella, you're asking for revival. You ain't going to get it with an NIV. You need to get a real Bible, and God might get you some revival. I was in church in Colorado one time, and a preacher had a gun on his side. He was preaching away. He was the county sheriff, and he happened to be the pastor at the same time. But he kept calling John the Baptizer. John the Baptizer. John the Baptizer. And so I just wrote him a little letter and said, you know, I appreciated your message. I appreciated, you know, you having a gun on your side and you're teaching the Word of God. But what in the world would you call him John the Baptizer for? Well, he was some new new version fella, and he should have been called, I guess, called John the Dipper or something like that, you know, the Johnny Immersionist or something. You know, I mean, you get all kinds out there, all kinds. So use those opportunities. Be faithful to the Lord. Verse 20, verse 21, to have respect of persons is not good, for a piece of bread that man will transgress. That's what you call politics. Every area you go, you're going to have face politics. That's partiality towards somebody. Respect of persons. That is a sin, according to James 2, 5, and 6. Respect of persons, that's when money comes under the table. That's when the judges, you know, give a guy a less sentence because he's got more money coming in. Okay, and that's a thing in all areas of life. It gets annoying. I don't care what field you're in. I don't care what organization you're a part of. You're going to find politics plays a role. It's not what you know, it's who you know. Okay, so that's 21. 22, did that take kick off? Okay, 22, look at this one real quick. We'll come back to it. But he that hasteth to be rich hath an evil eye. Now, does that ring a bell with a back of your Federal Reserve note? We hit on that a little bit more about secret societies and the all-seeing eye of Horus and how they are associated with people who want to get rich. Now, isn't that something? And that eye is going to be the left eye of the Antichrist. Okay, any questions or comments are we covering? Yes, ma'am. Nehemiah 13, 26 and 27. That's the one where it says that Solomon transgressed in marrying outlandish women. Anything else? Uh-huh. 23, 29. Jeremiah.